Hello, hello, hello. David Lloyd George here. Now, I was your Prime Minister 100 years ago today. And I'm looking down now, and I'm looking at what's happening with your Prime Minister now, and I'm thinking to myself, what are you lovely boys doing? You can't have a Prime Minister behaving like this. You can't have a Prime Minister losing Secretary of State for the Home Office, losing Chancellor of the Exchequer, only within a week of each other. What's going on? How have you managed to get such a bad Prime Minister? She, I don't know about it, but she must be the worst Prime Minister that Great Britain has ever had. What's going on? How have you managed to get such a terrible Prime Minister? And I was thinking to myself, the reasons, there's many reasons for it. First of all, she's not been elected on her ability. You've got to elect people on their ability, or you're going to get the worst kind of people, isn't it? You've got to elect people because they've suffered. They've got to have been through a hard time in life. Has she been through a hard time in life? No. They've got to emerge from among the party, from among the parliamentary party, haven't they? Because only then can the parliamentary party support them. But you lovely boys, you've got this stupid system which allows old age pensioners to elect the person in charge. What, I'm the person who created the old age pension. And I'm telling you, that is not the way you get a Prime Minister. Not a Prime Minister's going to work, not a Prime Minister's going to work for the long term. You lovely boys, I've made serious errors with your Prime Minister. And today, I want to look at why it is that Britain has elected the worst Prime Minister she's ever had. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today I'd like to talk about, well, if you're British, then it's the only thing you are talking about at the moment, and that is Liz Truss, who may well be the most appalling Prime Minister Britain has ever had, and I don't know if she will still be Prime Minister when I put this video out. What are the reasons why the Conservative Party has managed to select such an appalling, incompetent Prime Minister? Before I look at that, a quick word from our sponsor.
Before we start, I'd just like to say a word about our sponsor, and that is Atlas VPN. Now, here's the situation, chaps. We are all truth seekers here at the Jolly Heretic Public House. We all want to know the truth about the world, and the only way we can do that is if we get lots of different perspectives, lots of alternative perspectives. And we are in a situation where we cannot get that. The internet is censored, everything is censored, and we literally cannot get the other side with regard to certain important events that are happening in the world because of the way that they censor the internet. So the only thing to do, as far as I'm concerned, is to use a VPN. And Atlas VPN is currently running a huge discount. It means you can get a 3-month subscription for just $1.83 a month, plus 3 months for free, with a 30-day money-back guarantee. And so time is running out, so it's worth looking into, really. There's lots and lots of benefits to this. Not only is that you've got that deal, but you could unlock your favourite content from all over the world, you know, shows from friends or whatever it is you like are using Atlas VPN. You can keep your Google searches private. They make sure that your results aren't tracked and so forth. You can stop ads and malware. It's more than just a VPN. It blocks malicious links and ads and so forth, and it notifies you when someone's trying to steal your data. And you can save money online. It notifies you of the best deals, and it can protect unlimited devices. So it seems to be a jolly good idea. And as I say, they've currently got this campaign where it's just $1.83 a month. So, you know, it's worth thinking about. $1.83 a month for a 3-year subscription, plus 3 months for free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Time is running out, so, you know, it's certainly worth looking into. So as a person that is in favour of the truth and wants as much as many different perspectives as possible and is finding these blocked by our current system, I think getting a VPN is worth doing. And as far as I can see, Atlas VPN is where it's at, chaps.
There we go. All right. So what's going on with Liz Truss? Why is she so rubbish? Why have the Conservative Party managed to select such an appalling Prime Minister? Well, there's three kinds of reason for it. One is broader sort of sociological trends. That's the first thing. The second thing is simply a very bad system via which she has been selected, which has finally come into its own. And the third reason is just the general cycle of political parties, which can be compared in many ways to the cycle of civilization. So with the first things, first of all then, obviously, for a good 20 years now, the Conservative Party has not been selecting its best. The Conservative Party selects candidates based primarily, really, on their sex
and what ethnicity they are. There has been tremendous pressure, particularly since the time of David Cameron, to have not all women shortlists, but de facto all women shortlists. So you might get 100 people that apply to be the prospective parliamentary candidate for a seat. These are whittled down to 3 people who are put before the membership of the party, who are generally sort of over the age of 65, upper middle class people. But the rule is that one of those 3 must be a woman. And even if you have 10 men who are, you know, if you rank the 100 people that have applied to be the Member of Parliament in order, and 1 to 9 is a man and the 10th is a woman, the 3 people who are who are put before the Conservative Association to do speeches so that one of them can be selected, one of those 3 must be a woman. In addition, there is strong pressure from central office for politically correct reasons to select a woman. And so, therefore, what you get is a situation where the best people, who may well be men, are not selected, and it is a woman who is selected. So increasingly, therefore, the Conservative Party is not selecting its best. There is a similar kind of pressure, though not to the same extent and not so overtly, that is placed in terms of ethnic minorities. There is a strong pressure to get more and more Conservative ethnic minority MPs. And so for the same reason, ethnic minorities, via a system that head office has, are parachuted onto certain seats, and a great deal of rural seats. Suella Braverman is an example of this. And they are pressured to select an ethnic minority in seats which are, of course, going to be overwhelmingly white and to whom they have no connection whatsoever. Now, this kind of process occurred with Liz Truss. Liz Truss was an A-list candidate. She was parachuted onto her seat in Norfolk. They then discovered that she'd had an adulterous affair, while she'd been a parliamentary researcher for an MP. She hadn't revealed this, and so there was an extraordinary meeting of the local Conservative Association, and they tried to overturn her candidacy. And a great deal of pressure was put onto them by David Cameron not to overturn her candidacy, and in the end she got through and she became an MP. So that's the first thing, then. They're not selecting the best people to be MPs. They are increasingly selecting people based on other factors, and that is now starting to come through in who is available in the pool of people to be leader. The second reason is that you no longer have a pool of people who have suffered. Now, this is very important. In order to deal with adversity, in order to deal with difficult things happening, in order to deal with the cut and thrust of politics, it's quite useful that you have been through unpleasantness, that you have suffered in your life, and you have therefore developed coping mechanisms in order to deal with difficult situations, in order to deal with suffering. Now, that used to be true of a lot of MPs for a number of reasons. First of all, because everybody, until perhaps the generation born in the 50s or 60s, had gone through a certain degree of suffering in life. Everybody had experienced, you know, corporal punishment at schools. Everybody had perhaps experienced the death of a relative when they were relatively young. Everybody had perhaps experienced the death of a sibling. Everybody had experienced difficulties. Everybody had experienced want. A lot of people had experienced want of food or whatever in a very real sense, in a way that is no longer the case. So you have a kind of decadence where people don't undergo any kind of suffering anymore. And those people come through. But one of the things that you used to have in Parliament until the sort of 30 years ago, which you didn't have that many middle-class people. Parliamentarians were not well paid at all. And so it was a question of, could you afford to be an MP? Who could afford to be an MP? Well, it was the gentry. It was those that were independently wealthy. They could afford to be MPs. And it was the working class, because they were sponsored by the trade unions or whatever. They could afford to be MPs. And you didn't get very many middle class MPs, because they just couldn't afford to be MPs. And if you look at the autobiographies of people like Kenneth Clarke, or who was a barrister, they had to be an MP and work They had to work as a barrister or whatever in the day, and then Parliament would start sitting at about 2:30 in the afternoon, and then make their way to Parliament, sit well into the evening, then go to work. He sometimes used to sleep at railway stations, and then get up in the morning and go to work as a barrister, and then make his way to London. This is the kind of situation they were in. Now, that is no longer the case. So you used to have people, therefore, who were the gentry, who had been to public school, who had been, and what does public school, traditionally, what does public school do? It's based on Sparta. It's based on the Spartan ideals that you take the children away from their parents, that you inculcate them with the ideas of the tribe, that they are made to suffer in a structured fashion, that they are beaten, that they are exposed to profound unpleasantness, and that this breaks their bond with their family. It breaks their bond. It breaks their sense of self in a way, and it forces them to develop a new sense of self, which is based around doing their duty by their group. That was the public school system. So you used to have a lot of people who had been through that, who had therefore suffered, and then of course you had the working class MPs. Well, of course they had suffered. They had suffered genuine struggles and genuine want, and they really knew what it was to suffer and to have indignities and to know what it was to go through, you know, significant psychological and physical pain. So you have those kinds of people. Well, those kinds of people are now gone, first of all, because you no longer have really any working class MPs at all, because there was this great change that occurred between the, I don't know, after the war, whereby there was a lot of social movement because of meritocracy, and all of the working class people that were reasonably intelligent moved up. And so you don't get people like that now. And secondly, because of the changes in the way MPs are paid, that you no longer get so many working class MPs. And thirdly, because for various reasons, it's increasingly socially unacceptable to be gentry and to go into politics. There's fewer and fewer gentry that go into politics. So you no longer get people like that who have gone through serious suffering and whatever. Now, then the next issue that means is you get relatively few people that have this profound sense of duty, because that's one of the things that the public school system inculcated people with, was not to be individualistic, but a profound sense of duty to your group. And you also had this, I suppose, to some extent with the working class labour movement, with the idea that you have a sense of duty to your social class. You have a group-oriented society in which you you yourself suffer for the good of the group to which you belong, whether it is the working class or whether it is England as a whole and the empire or whatever. Well, this has now changed, and this is we are now a highly individualistic society in which we are encouraged to think of the good of ourselves. The result of that is that people who might in the old days have thought to themselves, I will go into politics, I will become prime minister, let's say, at a particularly difficult time where I'm likely to lose the next election. Those people don't put themselves forward. And so it's only those that are highly, highly ambitious, or those that have a sort of narcissistic balloon sense of their own importance or whatever, that put themselves forward, and nobody else does. This is the next problem. The next problem, I think, is, I mean, it's a broad problem that impacts everything, but I think we must be seeing it now, really, is simply low intelligence. The standard of the IQ of Britain has gone, we lost 15 IQ points between 1880 and the year 2000 due to the negative correlation between intelligence and how many children you have. We've lost another 10 points since then. We have the standard of IQ among people born in the 70s is significantly lower than the standard of born in the 50s or the 40s or the 30s, and so you just get lower IQ. What does lower IQ result in? It results in a political system that is more fractious, where there is less loyalty, where there is less hard work, where there is less trust, where there is less planning for the future, where there are all of these kinds of factors. And that's what you're seeing with the Liz Truss premiership. You're seeing an expression in many ways of just sort of low IQ traits, and people unable to get on, and people unable to plan, and people unable to think of the consequences of their actions. And what's the result of that? Well, it's the chaos that we now see. So that's the first set of reasons why the Conservative Party has selected such a terrible leader. The second set of reasons is to do with the nature of the system. We are pack animals, and we are evolved to live in tribes of about 150 people. The way it is supposed to work is that our leaders emerge from among us, and we know them. And this is a lot of research on business dynamics has shown this, that it's better to have a group, whatever working group you have, it should be about 150 people. And it's a very bad idea for the leader of that group to be imposed from outside, as often happens when a school, for example, might appoint a new headmaster. It's much better that the headmaster is the deputy headmaster and moves up into his position or something than it is that somebody from outside emerges, is imposed on the group. It should be that the person is a member of the group and emerges from within that group. That is the system that works psychologically, and that is the system that is likely to produce a leader who has the support of the majority of his or her party and is therefore able to be the right person to lead the group and to be given the benefit of the doubt and so on and to get on with it. Well, that's not what's been happening in the Conservative Party. That was what happened in the Conservative Party until 1965, when there had to be a new leader. Soundings were taken behind the scenes. It was worked out who was the right person, who was the person that had the support of the party and so forth. And so that new leader emerged and that person was in charge. Now, in 1965, under pressure from the democratizing tendencies in the country as a whole, Sir Alec Douglas Hume introduced a system of election whereby the parliamentary party would elect their leader. Now, even then, that person, obviously, he's leading the parliamentary party, and so he emerges from among the parliamentary party and is able eventually, through horse trading and whatever, to claim the support of the majority of the parliamentary party. So this is obviously a very good system, essentially. I mean, there might be some factionalism and whatever that complicates this, but basically it means that the right person can emerge and will have the support of the party. And most importantly, that the members of parliament will know intimately other members of parliament, will know them very well and will really know their strengths and weaknesses. And so it's ensured that the right kind of person is in charge. Under William Hague, they changed the system to make the party more democratic, and they brought in a system whereby the members of parliament voted for whittled down the field of people that wanted to be leader to two people, and those people were put before the membership. Now, that's a fundamentally bad system. It may sound terribly democratic, but it's a fundamentally bad system because it means that a person who is not does not necessarily support command the support of the parliamentarians can simply get through somehow and win. And therefore, he doesn't have the support of parliamentarians. They know him well. They don't think he's the right person for the job. As far as they're concerned, he's not the right person for the job. But he is imposed on them as leader by a party that is not representative in the country of the MPs. The MPs are way to the left of the parliamentary party. They're way younger than the parliamentary party. They're going to be, on average, way more intelligent than the members of the parliamentary party. They're going to have a different personality type from the parliamentary party. But most important, these people in the parliamentary party, they just know what they see on TV. They don't know really how these MPs operate. They don't know them well at all. So they could select somebody for the wrong reasons. Now, this is what happened, as I'll turn to it in a minute, but this is what happened with Ian Duncan Smith. You had this situation where the person, when William Hague lost the 2001 election, they should have had Kenneth Clark as their leader. And I'm fairly confident that if it had been between Kenneth Clark and Ian Duncan Smith and just the MPs, then Kenneth Clark, even though he was to the left of the party and he was a Europhile, would have been elected the leader. But that wasn't able to happen. It was put out to the party membership, and you had this utterly inexperienced person that was elected just because he was Eurosceptic and right-wing. He was totally useless, and he was the first Conservative leader, first Conservative leader since Neville Chamberlain, that was never put before an electorate. That he was withdrawn as leader before he could be put before an electorate because he was so useless. And it's looking like now Liz Truss is going to be in a similar situation to him. And is going to just be removed because she's so utterly useless. And very similar to Ian Duncan Smith as well. Lacking in personality, insipid, a sort of non-player character type person. So it's a very bad system. And that's the next reason. Now, the third reason is really, if you just look at it in terms of the cycles of civilization. How do the cycle? Let's reduce it down to Oswald Spengler, cycles of civilization, and let's impose this model on groups. The Dark Ages, the new group, having suffered, having undergone all kinds of privations and whatever, having really suffered and felt unpleasantness and emerges in the spring. It's youthful. It's brimming with confidence. It's inquisitive. It's childlike. But it's got this sense of its own importance, and it's got and it develops this religiousness and whatever to cope with the situation. And it's certain and it's profound and whatever. And then in the summer, it develops. It has all the joy of youth and inquisitiveness of youth, and it conquers and it invades other places that are worn out and it whatever. Okay, and then in autumn, it starts to get old, but the fruits of civilization come in. It's learned and it's developed and so on, and therefore the harvest comes in and you see all of its brilliance, and then it just starts to get old. It runs out of energy. It's not young anymore. It doesn't know what it wants anymore. It turns into a sort of a bureaucracy. It loses its religiousness. It loses its sense of its own brilliance. It loses its sense of its own importance, and it just becomes old and stale, and then it dies. And not only does it die, but it is displaced by the enemy at the gate. It is displaced in terms of Ibn Khaldun. It is displaced by the new. It becomes decadent. It creates cities. It creates luxury, and it loses its martial values. It forgets what it was that meant it had to struggle. It doesn't have to struggle anymore. Everything's handed to it on a plate, and it becomes lazy, and it becomes decadent, and it stops fearing the gods. And then there is a new desert tribesman, as Ibn Khaldun calls them, at the gate, and that desert tribesman has all the fervor of youth, and in that desert tribesman comes and it replaces the old group, and then it just goes through the same process all over again. And you can see that there's something like this that seems to happen with political parties. They start off, your New Labour has changed, your New Labour, blah blah blah, and all this, and they're full of fervour, and they know what they want to do, and they've got all these ideas, and eventually, as they're in power for a very long time, they kind of feel that power, they forget they have to struggle for it. They stop struggling. There is no struggle. It's handed to them. They have power, and so they become lazy and decadent. And then eventually, their charismatic leader, for whatever reason, has to go. And is replaced by a boring, stale bureaucrat. And at the same time that happens, the opposition party that's been suffering and languishing in opposition has selected someone good as their leader, and then in they come. Well, it's a very, very similar process. You can see this with the Labour Party in the 1980s, and you can see it with the Conservative Party in the 2000s. The parallels don't exactly work, but basically it really kind of fits with it's sort of Kubler-Ross's theory of grief. So it starts off that because the Labour Party are out on their ear, they're in denial. They're in denial. They can't quite believe what's happened. They can't believe that they're out of power. They're in denial. They assume that the people just don't quite understand them or whatever. And so they elect somebody that's rather extreme, really. That's just even very, very left wing. Even though they've been rejected in part for being too left wing. You get Michael Foot. You get this very, very left wing, silly old man who's clearly unsuitable to be prime minister. They then suffer even a massive defeat in 1983, even worse than their defeat was in 1979. So they select Neil Kinnock, who, okay, he's a kind of a compromise candidate. He's not too left-wing, like Tony Benn or whatever, but he's still pretty left-wing. He's a sort of compromise candidate. He's really not very good. They stick with him for 9 years. They suffer two more election defeats. Then finally they realise they've done something very, very wrong, and they select a candidate that is more sort of up-and-coming and more charismatic in the form of John Smith. He then drops dead. You then get Tony Blair, and that's it. There's the Reformation, there's the revival of the party, and this is happening at just the time the Conservative Party has been in the power a long time, doesn't really know what it wants to do, has bureaucratised, is stale, has run out of ideas, has run out of passion. And then, of course, Tony Blair wins in a massive landslide, and that's it, the New Labour are in. Then within the Conservative Party, 1997, massive defeat. What do they do? They're in total denial. They have been in power for 18 years. They can't believe this happens. Well, Michael Portillo, who was supposed to be leader, he's out. He's lost his seat. And they don't particularly want to elect Ken. What they should do in a situation like that is elect a caretaker leader who is popular in the country, who is popular among themselves, and they should sort of sort themselves out and work out what they need to do and revive themselves and whatever, under this caretaker leader, who it should be accepted is never going to be prime minister, ever. and then they should find an appropriate leader to take them into the next election. But that's not what they do. That's not what Labour did, and it's not what they do. They think they can win the next election. They're in denial. So what they do is it's between Clark and William Hague, and they elect William Hague because he's young, because he's their sort of version of Tony Blair, but he's not, because their version of Tony Blair is Michael Portillo, and he's lost his seat. He's inexperienced, he's naive, he makes all kinds of silly decisions, and it's an absolute disaster, and they make a net gain of one seat at the next election. Now then, they're still in denial, they can't believe this has happened. And so what do they do? Again, they should elect a caretaker leader in the form of Ken Clark. Perhaps they would have done if it had just been up to the parliamentary party, but it wasn't. It was up to the members in the country, and so they elect someone even more extreme than William Hague, this very inexperienced, very naive man who's got no idea what he's doing, Ian Duncan Smith. And then it's realised that if they carry on like this, they're going to be destroyed. And that's when finally, in 2003, it finally hits them. They're out of power. They move from being in denial to the negotiating of the death phase, or the acceptance even of the defeat. And then you have Michael Howard, the grand old man, the caretaker leader, and under him there's soundings that are taken, and Cameron emerges. And then Cameron is so obviously the right choice for leader that he is elected both by the parliamentary party and by the membership, and that's it. Then we have Cameron in. Now then we have a crisis, a total crisis after the Brexit vote. What do we do? Oh my God! What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? So you need some sort of bureaucrat to steady the ship or whatever, but and someone that can calm things down. So they go with Theresa May, but she's just a bureaucrat. She doesn't inspire anybody or whatever, and so Labour starts to do better because she's such a dull leader. So they have to find some, either they have to go out of power, or they have to find someone who could inspire them and get them through the crisis of Brexit. They do. They get this charismatic figure, Boris Johnson. He gets them through. He inspires them and whatever. He has the support both of the party in the country and of the parliamentary party. He does the one thing he's elected to do, which is Brexit. But after that, all of the negative sides of charisma come through, which is that you're a liar and that you're dishonest and whatever. And at the same time, well, there's nothing else they have to do. The one thing that they could galvanise the country and themselves to do was Brexit. But once they've done that, they haven't really had anything else to do. And they've been in power almost 10 years and there's nothing else to do. And so therefore, he is removed and you end up with this party that is just not accepting its own decline, that is the ultimate bureaucrat, the ultimate doll person, the ultimate runner, the ultimate NPC meme. And that, of course, is Liz Truss. And you have something similar, I think, if you look at the Labour Party, if you go back, you have something similar. They lose. They are under Gordon Brown, who is a bureaucrat, a dull bureaucrat. They replace him with some extreme leftist who isn't very inspiring and whatever. So they're not accepting they've lost. He's out. You then have the Ian Duncan Smith. You have the Jeremy Corbyn, the real extreme fundamentalist reaction against defeat. Of course, that doesn't work. He's out. And then against that defeat, then finally they realise, oh God, we've got to do something. And they get somebody, well, he's not particularly charismatic, but he's got something about him, which is Keir Starmer, who I suspect will lead them into the next election. So those are the three reasons why. But I mean, it is extraordinary that we have I can barely bring myself to do an impression of her. More pork products. What should you be Prime Minister, Mrs. Truss? What I am doing in my funny accent, where it's a bit rural, but it's a bit not, is just speaking very slowly and just without any confidence. It's amazing. But these are the reasons why we have managed to elect the worst Prime Minister in British history.
Hello, hello, hello! The Jolly Heretic is an online public house which meets on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss the kind of based, fearless science which is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you would like to help the Jolly Heretic public house, and there are many ways you can do so, please, please, please become one of my patrons on Subscribestar. Also, if you want to, you can donate to the channel using Odyssey and Entropy, and you can also purchase Jolly Heretic merchandise such as shirts and mugs. All of the links are in the description. Again, I'd be most violently grateful if you could assist the Jolly Heretic Public House, and I will see you all soon, and goodbye!